Sunshine Meets on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
Hello, good evening, and you're very welcome to Sunshine Meets. Over the next hour, we'll be chatting to a man best known as journalist, author, and comedy writer, Paul Howard. Paul, it's great to have you in the studio.
Pleasure, great to be here.
Paul, we'll be looking at some of the music which had a big influence and shaped you. But I suppose, firstly, a lot of people's early musical memories are shaped by their family. What kind of music would have been played around the Howard household in the 1970s?
My parents were very nostalgic about the 60s. I kind of grew up in a 60s house, really. They were just the right age to really be swept along by the 60s. You know, they were both born in 45, and then, you know, they moved to England when they were teenagers, you know, so the 60s was it. My dad saw the Beatles in the Cavern Club in Liverpool. My dad was on the ships and he was in the Merchant Navy, and his friend Brian Kelligan said to him one day, I've heard about this band called the Beatles, and they're on at the Cavern Club. And my dad, you know, left saying, one of the worst bands I've ever heard in my life, you know. But he also saw the Rolling Stones in Kentish Town, above a pub in Kentish Town, when they, like, early on, you know, when Brian Jones was there, and they were, you know, they were kind of just a covers band then, you know. They were playing, like, you know, Muddy Waters and stuff like that, you know. And so they loved all that stuff, the 60s stuff. And so it kind of became the soundtrack of our lives, really. Because on a Sunday afternoon, a Sunday lunchtime, Jimmy Savile, as it happens, used to do this radio show where he would kind of ask a pop quiz question about the following track, and then you know my mom and dad were guessing across the table who it was, all that kind of thing. So, you know, a lot of it wasn't Beatles and Stones stuff, that it was, they were kind of more obscure 60s tracks like Hermits and stuff like that. So it was always 60s music. And Elvis Presley, my mum was a huge Elvis Presley fan. My first memory, it's quite late, I was about six at the time, but my strongest early memory is my mother crying for 3 days when Elvis Presley died.
Really?
She just bawled for 3 days nonstop. Because it was a little bit of her childhood dying, like, you know, that she kind of felt, right, I'm an adult now. Now, she had four children at the time. She was very much an adult. But I think it was just that thing, you know, just letting go of those glorious years, you know.
I think listeners may not realise that you were born in London and you spent your formative years in London before moving back to Ireland. And I want to ask about that in a moment. But obviously, being an Irish person in 60s UK would have been quite challenging, I imagine, for your parents?
I don't know. Actually, I mean, I don't think so. My dad hears, you know, these stories about, you know, signs up saying no blacks, no Irish, no dogs. And my dad's exposure to England was completely different, you know. He doesn't remember that. He doesn't remember hostility. His brothers, who were all in England, do remember hostility, but they were going on marches. Like, my uncle Fran would be on these marches, like, you know, Brits out of Ireland marches, you know, and then he'd say to my dad, God, there's terrible harassment of Irish people here. And my dad's like, why do you go on the marches? Like, you know, but like that, Fran was in a flat in Peckham, and he was playing like rebel songs off the you know, the top of this flat in Peckham. And wondering why English people were hostile to him. No, but my dad's experience was totally different. When we lived in London, I went over to see a Spurs match with Dad recently, and we were walking down Regent Street, and he said, oh, this is my old round. And I said, what do you mean? He said, Dad worked in the post office in London. He said, I used to deliver parcels in this area. I said, when? He said, oh, early 70s, sort of 73, 74. And that was the height of an IRA parcel bombing campaign. And my dad was the parcel man on Regent Street. And I said, did anybody ever call you in and say, you know, were you ever questioned or anything? No, just was accepted, you know. And then dad always reckoned that English people were the most tolerant people in the world. And I suppose there's reasons to question that now, but certainly growing up, We had a sense of our Irishness in England, but we didn't get any anti-Irish feeling when we lived there. We moved from London up to Luton when I was about maybe 4 or 5. And we lived in an Irish, it was really an Irish community there. Like, we went to a local St. Vincent's Roman Catholic lower school, it was called. So all the kids in our class were called Mar, Byrne, O'Hare. It was all second generation Irish kids. And Dad worked there. He worked for Vauxhall and Skeff. And so it's in the motor industry. And, you know, 50% of the shop floor was Irish. So it was that was a very Irish community. So there was definitely none of it there. But Dad said in London, he didn't get any, nobody ever made an issue of his Irishness.
So when was the decision to up sticks and move home?
Dad said, in 1979, Dad said that if Margaret Thatcher got in, we'd move back to Ireland. And we thought he was joking. You know, we really did think he was joking.
Packing the bag. Still a joke,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. You know the way Americans always say, you know, if Trump gets in, I'm moving to Canada and stuff like that. And we kind of thought that was our moving to Canada thing. But anyway, within 4 weeks, we were gone, you know. And Dad, we weren't going to Ireland for anything other than Dad had a sense that, you know, being a working class family, reliant on a factory wage, four children under the age of 10, that the vision Thatcher had for Britain, deindustrialization of Britain, wasn't going to be good for families like ours. It wasn't going to be good news for us. And I remember it was within weeks. I remember the last day in that school, you know, dancing to a Boney M song, Holiday. Everyone was going off on their holidays, but we were going on a, you know that song? Hooray, hooray, it's a hard holiday. I remember dancing to that, running around dancing. But we were going away for a permanent holiday. You know, we were going back to Ireland. I was very brave of my parents because there was no emigrant traffic going the other way. It was kind of anti-emigration as a move. Like, we were moving back to Ireland, which was economically very depressed. We didn't have anywhere to live. They didn't have a house. We knew we were going on the waiting list for a council house. And Dad had £100 in his pocket and four children under the age of 10. Quite nowhere to live.
It's quite prophetic though, isn't it? You know, when you think now where we are with Brexit and...
Yeah. He was just really smart, my dad, like, you know, he still is. Like, he's still the cleverest man I know. And but he just had a sense that Thatcher's Britain wasn't going to be somewhere that he wanted to live. And he was right, you know, within 2 years... You know, there was riots in Brixton and Toxteth, and we're watching that on the television, you know, and that great song of the era, Ghost Town by the Specials, you know. When I hear that song, I always think of those couple of years after we left England and looking back over our shoulder saying, you know, Dad saying, I'm glad we're not grown up in Luton, like, because Luton was very
decimated,
rough.
Decimated as well.
It was decimated, and once a lot of industry was pulled out of it, it just, you know, large areas of it were ghettoised. I mean, it was quite rough when we lived there, but it was, you know, we look back and said, yeah, we did the right thing.
When you moved to Dublin then, were you kind of isolated really with an English accent into an Irish school? Was that challenging for a little while?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was more than challenging, you know, because we had
talk it out.
We had Grange Hill accents, like, you know, we grew up in England with a sense of our Irishness, but we came to Ireland, you know, those were the really horrible years of the Troubles, you know, 79, 80, 81, the hunger strikes. Those sort of first 2 years when we started school, and there was a lot of anti-English feeling in Ireland. And, you know, we never got anti-Irish feeling in England, but when we came here, we definitely felt that. I remember, you know, being in Dunleary and seeing graffiti, Brits out, Smash H Block, all that kind of thing. And, that you know, that's what we were seeing before we started school. I remember my brother saying to my mother, what are they going to do to us when we start school? And having that fear. And during the hunger strikes, you know, it was, you know, we were just fighting all the time. I just remember that we went to one school in Monkstown Farm where Des Cahill's dad was the principal, actually, Mr. Cahill.
My mother grew up on Monkstown Farm, so I know quite well.
Oh, right, okay. That's where we went to school. And we were fighting. I just remember fighting three or four times a week, there'd be a fight, a group around you in the playground, and you're standing in the middle fighting some guy you didn't even know, you know. And then the hunger strikes was the worst. That was, you know, I remember my brother saying to my mother, like, you know, my mother saying to my brother, you know, I can't remember which one of them was. It might have been Martin Hurson. Martin Hurson died last night. My brother saying, "Who's Martin Hurson?" My mother saying, "He's one of the hunger strikers." And my brother said, "How many of these guys are there?" And it was kind of, it's kind of funny looking back, but we just knew we were going in that day and we were going to be fighting, you know. So I suppose it was a kind of incentive to lose the English accent, but it hung around for a couple of years. Like, we were proper, like, cool, blimey, watch your mate, English people, like, you know, in this strange country that suddenly felt very, very foreign.
Your first choice of song is by Bruce Springsteen. And it's interesting that you chose the live version. So a bit of background of, it was the opening track of Born to Run, and his first two albums had sold quite poorly. So this is 1975. And the song is Thunder Road.
Thunder Road.
It's the live version. So you've obviously seen him live.
I have seen him live, yeah. And it's the greatest concert experience you will ever have. And that's why, you know, when he puts 200,000 tickets on sale, they're gone within half an hour, like, because everybody knows just how great he is live and how he still loves to play live. You can see his enthusiasm for the music. Like, a lot of bands who are touring the world now are doing it because CD sales have decimated their pension funds. I saw the Police at Croke Park a few years ago, and they just clearly didn't want to be around each other. They were just clearly doing it for the money. But Springsteen puts the passion into it. I think Born to Run is my favourite album. I think it's the greatest album ever recorded. I loved his first two albums as well. And this song, Thunder Road, I think it's probably my favourite song of all time. And the live version, the reason I asked for the live version, it's just, there's just something that is passion in the voice, the passion in the voice. And, you know, I can hear him, and I can hear him on that doorstep. One of the things I love about this song is it actually opens, like, the opening is like stage directions to a play. The screen door slams, Mary's dress waves, like a vision, she dances across the porch as the radio plays Roy Orbison singing for the lonely. It's like the opening of a Tennessee Williams play or something, and it just sets up this brilliant song that has all these kind of changes in pace and mood, and it's the ultimate rock and roll song to me, because it's a guy standing under the window or standing on the porch saying to a girl, come with me, come on the road.
Sunshine Meets on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
Welcome back, and we're here with Paul Howard, and we're going to find out a little bit more about your transition into journalism. And I suppose, firstly, Paul, you're initially known and originally sprung to prominence as a writer, and can you just give us a bit of background before you got the prestigious role in the Sunday Tribune, but a lot of hard work had gone on before then.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to be a writer from the time I was about 11. I wanted to be a sports journalist. I used to sit and watch football matches, like the 1982 World Cup, the 1986 World Cup. I'd sit and watch all the matches, and I'd do a little report, like a sort of two paragraph report on each. And then I do the stuff that you and I did later on when we were freelancing, like, you know, scores and scorers, teams, making sure you spell everyone's name right, substitutions, all that kind of thing, the minute, red cards, yellow cards, all that. And I kept these copybooks. I still have them. My mother hung on to them for years and years. And I knew from really, really young age that I wanted to be a sports writer. It's all I ever wanted to do. And I knew from about the time I was 13, I wanted to be a sports writer for the Sunday Tribune. That was the paper I wanted to work for. But it was how to get there. And I wasn't great at school. I mean, I just wasn't a good student at school. Like, you know, I didn't get a great Leaving Cert. And I didn't apply for anywhere. I didn't apply for college. I just wanted to leave school and go and start freelancing. You know, I was really keen to get into it. I'd had some letters to the editor published in, like, Soccer Magazine and the Evening Press. I won the £5 star letter about five times in the Evening Press. And so I'd been published in newspapers with a little byline at the end, you know. So I kind of thought, I can do this. I don't want to spend 4 years in college. And I really regret that to this day. But when I left school, I got a job as a caption writer with John Hind, the postcard factory in Cabinteely. So I was writing those 50-word captions you see on the backs of postcards, you know. So I had a room, a little office, bare walls, a desk, typewriter, and a shelf full of books. I always say it was like a Stasi interview room. It was just completely bare. And the shelf of books. And then I would get a list and it would say, you know, Cork City, Cashel, the Rock of Cashel, the Ring of Kerry, Dingle, Wexford Town. And I would have to write 50-word captions for all those, you know, just sum up Wexford Town. And so I'd pick up these books. No internet, of course, in those days, no computer. And I'd key in these captions on this thing, this typewriter. And at night then, I was freelancing, just writing for Southside, which was the local newspaper, just writing local stories. The council were considering closing the Blue Pool in Monkstown, things like that, you know, just stories of local interest. And the Southside was owned by the Sunday Tribune at the time. And I remember going into Southside with my first piece of copy typed up, and I walked up the stairs and I walked into the newsroom, and Vincent Brown was in his office, and he was screaming at somebody across the newsroom floor, absolutely screaming. And Gene Kerrigan was sitting across the way, and David Walsh and Paul Kimmage were on the sports desk. Jerry Barry walked in. He was the political correspondent. These are just heroes of mine, you know. And the atmosphere in there, everybody was smoking. Like, it was just thick. The air was thick with smoke. Everybody was stressed. Everyone was up against deadline, hammering away on keyboards. Everybody's angry. There's lots of shouting back and forth. And I remember then just saying, I didn't want to go back to the postcard factory. I just kind of wanted to be here all the time. And so that was really how I got into a newspaper full time.
The Sunday Beat would have given you the freedom. Obviously, you have to produce outstanding work every week and you're under major scrutiny, but it would have given you the freedom, I suppose, to do that bit more research around topics of interest.
I mean, it's funny now when I, you know, everything is instant now. I mean, in those days, you could do an interview and you know, you could be sure that nothing was going to break between then and Sunday. But now news just breaks on a, you know, minute by minute basis. So the idea of having that luxury to go off and spend, you know, sometimes weeks researching a subject, you know, I don't think sports journalists generally get that kind of freedom now. There's probably only maybe a handful of them who can actually take their time over a piece. I was really fortunate in the Tribune that we were given that leeway, you know, that if you said, I've got this idea for a piece, but it's going to involve me, you know, going to Portugal and I might not have it for 3 weeks, they would just trust you. You know, they would trust you to do it. But now there's so many pressures, not just time pressures, but also financial pressures on newspapers, that sports journalists generally don't have that luxury now. You know, it's kind of, I mean, even covering a match live now, that it has to be instant. Like the idea you could write a match report for the following day just seems so quaint now. You know, the idea that people would actually pick it up 24 hours nearly after seeing the match and read it, it just seems so old world now.
You know, I've worked in a newspaper that went bust, in a Dublin Daily, you were Sunday Tribune, and you know, The Times, sadly this week the Irish version, and a lot of good talented journalists. But questioning the role of the journalist now, you know, when you look at sport, you look at football, and Mark Tighe, the work he would have done on Sunday Times, and there were others as well. It'd be unfair just to label on Mark, but that just would indicate that there is a want, there is a desire, and maybe something, a story like that he'd obviously been working on for a long period of time.
You know, I'm not sure there is a want or a desire. I mean, there's a need. I know that for a fact. I mean, we wouldn't know about John Delaney today. We wouldn't know about Maria Bailey. You know, there's so many stories in the news we wouldn't know about if it wasn't for old-fashioned, pavement-pounding journalism. You know, just journalists going out there, caring about what they're doing, investigating. And if newspapers go, who's going to do that work? You know, people writing opinion pieces on their own blogs online aren't going to do that work. You know, the work of actually investigating. And, you know, it's a huge worry. You know, it's a huge worry, because I think certain people in political circles will be happy to see the end of the mainstream media. You know, I mean, Trump is certainly happy in America to see the New York Times, for instance, struggling. And it would probably be the greatest day of his life if the New York Times closed down. And there's a little bit of it here as well. You know, I did hear a politician recently say, who are the media answerable to? Who are the newspapers answerable to? And the idea is that they're not. They're answerable to the readership and the electorate, but they're not at the readership and I suppose democracy, really, you know. But there is this notion that they should be regulated, and the governments should be able to control what they say. And that's really sad. And it breaks my heart to see newspapers closing down. It breaks my heart to see newspapers letting journalists go. Good journalists as well. Like, we're not talking about poor journalists. We're talking about really, really good investigative journalists. They're discovering that there isn't a market there for what they do.
We're going to talk about one of the great characters you've produced and with great longevity shortly. But firstly, before we break into your second song, I'd love to hear your thoughts on The Joy and your book on Mountjoy Prison. What was that project like overall? And what was your objective in broader terms? And do you feel, are you comfortable now? Because I feel it stood the test of time, but it must have been a very arduous thing.
It was tough, yeah. I mean, I was kind of lucky in that. So it's a ghostwritten, it was ghostwritten with a former prisoner who spent most of his adult life in Mountjoy for nothing more serious than, and it is serious, but in I suppose in life terms it isn't, like jumping at a counter of a shop and grabbing money out of the till to feed a heroin addiction. And I mean, and people who've read the book, it's 23 years old now, like it's a long time ago since I wrote it. I think it's still in print, but it kind of, in terms of his life, it was very sad, because when we sat down to write the book, he was dying, and he was HIV positive, and he'd just gone full blown, and he knew he was going to die, and he knew he only had a limited amount of time left. And when he started telling me the stories, it was just from the time he was 14, he was just stuck in this cycle of addiction. He would be addicted. He would do something that would get him put in prison. He would get, you know, a year, 2 years in prison. He wouldn't get any treatment. He'd get out. He'd try to go clean. He'd get sucked back in again. And it was just such a tragic waste of a life. And he was such a smart guy as well. And so it's a really sad story. But even within that, there was great humour. I suppose one of the things I'm always drawn to is the humour in black situations, in dark situations. And while he's telling me horrific stories about life in Mountjoy, about spending, you know, 17, 18 years of his adult life in Mountjoy, they're kind of shot through with humour. And it's that sort of survival humour. You know, it's that you're in this miserable place and you have to find ways just to release that, you know. And so there was lots of humour in the book. I think I conveyed it as well, interspersed with these black scenes.
Because I think it ties in nicely with your next choice of song, Real Real Gone from Van Morrison. So you'd have been 19 in 1990 when this was released, and it wasn't a big hit, but
yeah,
it's a song that stood the test of time. But I think that touches on addiction and hope and lots of those are kind of recurring ideas.
I mean, you're a friend of mine and I'm real, real gone. I mean, it's just, I love that line. Like, I could have picked any Van Morrison song because I absolutely love Van Morrison. But I kind of thought I had to pick something a bit upbeat. Kind of, you didn't want to have me playing, like, you know, 9 minutes of Madame George or something, which I love. But this song in particular, it's one of those happy songs for me. When I feel like right now I want instant happy mood, I put on Real Real Gone. And when I finish a book, every time I finish a book, I have a little ritual. The second I type the last word, I have a bath ready, and I get in the bath. And I have a can of beer on the side of the bath, and I drink the beer. And then when I come back downstairs again, I put on Real Real Gone, and I play it really, really, really loud, which is the best way to play Real Real Gone. And it just instantly makes me happy. It's just one of those songs that does that.
Sunshine Meets on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
Welcome back, and we're here with Paul Howard in the final section of Sunshine Meets. Paul, Russell Carl Kelly, tell us a little bit about him.
Well, he was an accident, really. You know, he was kind of... I knew a lot of those type of guys growing up, like, you know. We lived in Ballybrack, which was sort of, you know, right next to Killiney, which is kind of a window on that world in a lot of ways, you know. I knew a lot of people, like, didn't know them personally, but I would have observed them and just kind of thought, what an idiot, you know. And I was getting on the Dart one day, and the train pulled in, and the first three or four carriages were completely full, just people like couldn't move. And I noticed the last carriage was empty. So I went down to the last carriage, and it's just like seven or eight guys in the carriage just wearing blazers. And why is nobody in here? So I pressed the buttons, the door opened, and one of them put his hand on my chest and said, "Sorry, dude, this is a rock carriage." And having been raised to believe that Blackrock College students would inherit the earth, I actually took a step backwards and apologised to him. And then the doors closed and he gave me the guns through the window as the train pulled away. So I suppose I had lots of experiences like that over the years. And then when I covered schools rugby, you know, I heard this kid say to his dad, who's a schools rugby player, say to his dad, "I don't give a bleep how you think I played. Just crack open the wallet, dude," to his father. And so I was covering schools rugby as a freelance reporter at the time, just doing markings for the Indo and the Times. And I had no exposure to this world, really, to schools rugby. I wasn't interested in rugby growing up. We were football and that was it. But going to schools matches for the first time, I suppose I saw this whole world of, you know, South Dublin privilege. Which nobody seemed to be laughing at, like, you know, nobody was sending this up. I kind of thought, this is amazing, you know, when you see these women, these mummies in the fur coats standing in the mud of Skerries in a fur coat, like, watching the sun play. And then I got a solicitor's letter from, I did a marking for the Indo, and it amazed me how many of the kids on the team, there were so many names to remember because everybody had two surnames and a hyphen in between. And I attributed a try to the wrong player. So, it, you know, say if it was scored by Gervin Murphy O'Connor, I said it was scored by, you know, Ross Harbison Blake or something. And the sports editor called me in and said, "Oh, we've had a solicitor's letter." And I said, why? And he said, "You got the name wrong." I said, "Solicitor's letter? Is that..." I thought, well, that's a bit heavy, you know. And he said, "You know, you got to remember, like, this, these families, they tell their son that don't mind your leaving cert. This is the most important thing in your life until you get to the age of 18. And he said, "The kid works his whole life to get on the senior cup team. He gets on the senior cup team. He goes out. He scores a try against Blackrock College. And you get his name wrong on the paper, and his dad is a solicitor. So what else is going
to
happen?"
But isn't it staggering to think, like, it's hilarious, and it stood the test of time across many generations. But the lack of self awareness is just extraordinary. And I would harbour a guess that the majority of people who absolutely love Russell Carl Kelly, the 18 books, the four plays that it's inspired, are exactly that stereotype.
Yeah, they are. I discovered this very, very early on. My plan was I was going to get under the skin of these people. And that's what you do when you satire. When you're a satirist, you think, I'm going to change the world. I'm going to show these people the error of their ways. And a friend of mine, very early on, I think it was the first or second book, he worked in Stephen's Green Shopping Centre in what was Hughes and Hughes. And he said, "The kids come in here on a Saturday morning. They don't buy your book, but they all stand around one copy." And he said, "They have the sailing jackets." He said, "They are your people." He said, "They have the sailing jackets. They have the chinos, the dubs." And he said, "All I hear is, that's so like Tiernan." So they were kind of seeing people adjacent to them, but not seeing themselves in it, you know. And then And then I kind of gave up on the idea that I was going to change them. And I just accepted that that's my audience, you know. So, like, three times a year, I'm in Blackrock College reading to the kids. And Alan McGinty rings me and says, you know, will you come out? And Alan will say, who's the principal of Blackrock College, he'll say, will you read to the transition year kids? We're doing a literacy week. Or he'll say, the Leaving Cert study students, they're studying really hard on study nights in the school. If you come in about 10 o'clock and maybe just do maybe half an hour. And I've kind of become their fool. Like, I'm kind of like, you know, in ancient times, they would say, the king would shout, bring me my fool. And the jester would come in. I'm kind of Blackrock's fool.
I was going to say Frankenstein then.
Yeah, yeah. And I just do this. I do half an hour of idiocy, and they all laugh at me. But I did read I gave the senior cup team their pep talk 1 year before they played Clongowes in the senior cup. Like, I gave the Blackrock senior cup team their pep talk as Ross O'Carroll Kelly. And that was when I realised, you know, it hasn't worked. I mean they're laughing at it. I mean, it's worked. I suppose it worked from that point of view. But this notion that I was going to get under their skin, that didn't work. Actually, as I got to Blackrock College, when I reached the school, there was a kid from Willow Park, the junior school, waiting for me on his own to take me down. And as I was walking, he was about 10 years old. He said to me, this is a major honour for someone like you. I said, is it? And he went, yeah, Jonah Lomu did this 2 years ago.
But I suppose, like any novelist, any writer, anything that's durable is obviously a great credit to you, really. And I suppose people kind of still identify, even people that don't come from the complete rugby background or whatever else, can still identify with aspects of it.
Yeah. I mean, it started off as a column in the Sunday Tribune, and it was a way of me mocking rugby culture, especially South Dublin rugby culture. And then the first column was in 1998, January 1998, so it's 21 years ago now. But the Celtic Tiger was just starting to take off at the time. And as the years went by, maybe 2-3 years in, it stopped being about rugby and started being about the changes that were happening in Ireland, about, you know, people were becoming more acquisitive, becoming much more aspirational. You had people's lifestyles were changing completely. The idea of borrowing huge amounts of money from a bank, you know, to buy a jet ski or a boat or, you know, to buy a plot of land to build an apartment block on, it didn't terrify people anymore. So there were all these sort of cultural lifestyle shifts happening. And I was kind of reflecting a lot of those. So it sort of ceased to be about rugby. And this rugby character just really became the sort of vehicle I used to write about wider society. And I think that's why people identified with it. You know, I was mocking people like my friends who I grew up with, who, you know, a friend of mine lives in the council estate, same council estate in Ballybrack that I grew up in, and they got a hot tub put in their garden. It was just the weirdest thing, because I called to the house one day and the whole family were in this hot tub, and they weren't the kind of family who ordinarily would have been comfortable being semi-naked around each other, like, you know, they were like the rest of us, kind of repressed Catholic family. And then suddenly this Celtic Tiger thing was happening, and that's my outstanding memory of the Celtic Tiger, this hot tub and in this house, in this garden, and all the family in it. Just strange. There was stuff like that I was kind of reflecting and sending up in a mocking way.
I think it's interesting. Look, sport is where you would have found your name initially, and I know you're into sports like boxing and snooker and obviously football as well. And the next song and the last song is by a Liverpoolian band who you've already mentioned. But just about Liverpool itself, the club and the city, I imagine you spent some time there as well.
Yeah.
It's a very Irish city.
It is a very Irish city. I love everything about Liverpool. I'm a Liverpool football fan. The Beatles are my favourite band. John Lennon is my hero. Like, every time we go to New York, I insist that Mary comes with me to the Dakota building. And I've got photographs. I've got 30 photos. I've been to New York 30 times, and I've got every single time I've gone, I've got a picture of myself taken outside the Dakota building. So I'm aging in these pictures. Like, it's a whole collection. And there's something magical about Liverpool. And it is very Irish. You're completely right. It's probably the most Irish city that England has. I wanted to live there. And I applied for a job in the Liverpool Echo around 1993. And to my great regret, I didn't go for the interview. I had a boat ticket on the boat, booked and everything. But I'm a home bird, and I thought I'd miss my friends, I'd miss my family. So I didn't go. And I do wonder sometimes my life would have been a lot different had I got on the boat. But I suppose the upside, I would have seen a lot of football because I would have been there. I would have been going to Liverpool all the time, you know. I love going to Liverpool. I just think it's a great city.
Well, this song is from Abbey Road, and it was first released in 1969. So written by George Harrison, who arguably has written probably three of the best Beatles songs,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
with Something and While My Guitar Gently Weeps. But also, this is Here Comes the Sun. Why did you choose this?
It's my funeral song.
That's lovely.
It's my funeral song. I think it's the song, it's the Beatles song I come back to time and time again. And I know it's written by the Beatles' third greatest songwriter, which is amazing when you think that George Harrison, as great as he was only number three. But it's again a mood song, you know. It's there's something, you know, whatever's going on in your life, whatever's going on in my life, when I listen to that song, it just completely chills me out. It's that line about, you know, I feel that ice is slowly melting, it feels like years since it's been here. It's just such a beautiful song and such a beautiful sentiment. And the story of it is that the Beatles were going through this really, really painful breaking up, and they were talking to lawyers, and there was just page and this great friendship, this beautiful friendship between these four men that created all of this music, this wonderful creative energy was leaving them. And they were all incredibly sad, and they were defensive, and they were paranoid. And George Harrison gets up and walks outside and picks up the guitar, and this song comes out of that. And it's just such a beautiful song. And I always tell Mary, my wife, whatever, do what you want for my funeral if I go first. But this is the song I want played at my funeral.
Sunshine has just met Paul Howard. Paul, thank you very much.
Pleasure.